Thank you for that generous introduction. I assure you the pleasure is all mine for being here for many Sundays, and I hope some more in the future. I've saved the best for last. We've been talking in this series about the impact of the printed word on people's lives in the 16th century and after. One of the most important things that happens in the Protestant Reformation is, and in a different way, the Catholic Reformation, is that the printed word becomes important in people's religious lives and other parts of their lives, but their religious lives in a dramatic new way. And that's a very important part of the Protestant story. It's not the only thing, but it's a huge, big part of the Protestant story. And I have been illustrating that with reference to a whole series of different kinds of writings that were part of that unfolding narrative. One of the most important, I mentioned at the very beginning, discussed at the very beginning, is an essay by Martin Luther called The Freedom of the Christian. Freedom of the Christian was a kind of clarion call to a new and different way of understanding the gospel that found wide circulation. And it found wide circulation because this, at the time, still not terribly well-known German monk, his writings are made available in pamphlet form, first in German and then in other languages all over Western Europe. It is, I think, a strikingly innovative work. It emphasizes something which is, I think, not self-evident, and that is that the Christian religion is a kind of liberation from all sorts of things that existed in people's lives at the time of the inception of Christianity. He emphasizes that theme in Paul. All the rules and regulations of Judaism are now set aside, and a new gospel is available to us. That was just extraordinary in its impact at the time of the Reformation. One of its impacts was a political upheaval, the peasants' revolt. I talked about a sermon by Thomas Munzer, which again found a wide circulation because of the printed word. Otherwise, it would just been a sermon. A highly provocative sermon, to be sure, but just a sermon. But it became something much more because of the printed word. Then I talked about Calvin's Institutes, a book, 200 pages, 300 pages, 400 pages, 500 pages, eventually 1,600 pages. A book, that's another part of the unfolding of this impact of the printed word. It started out with a little manual, only 200 pages, for the ordinary parishioner, if you will, sort of summarizing the essentials of the Christian faith as understood in this particular world, the Protestant Reformed world. But then it grew into a theological treatise, a tome, that was hugely important in shaping the education of pastors. Can't really exaggerate the importance of that. One of the great claims of the Reformation was, not claims, demands of the Reformation was, we want an educated clergy. People who can read the Bible in the original languages. People who are sufficiently learned about all kinds of matters that they can interpret Scripture well Sunday after Sunday after Sunday after Sunday, clearly building a kind of culture. Calvin's Institutes were pivotal to that. Now, that's another different kind of printed word. That's not for every man. That's for a certain kind of person, church professional, if you will. It wasn't intended initially, but that's the way it ended up. But all of those things are quite secondary to the one thing which really, it was just dynamite, literally a stick of dynamite under the inherited Christian religion. All of them Catholics, moving to reinvent the Christian religion. and the most explosive, the most revolutionary thing which they did. And it's understood to be not just explosive and revolutionary in religion, but in other matters as well. That is making the Bible available to lay people in the vernacular, in their own language. Say it again. Making the Bible available to people in the vernacular and saying to lay people, this was kind of an article of faith with Luther. They need to read it for themselves. They need to think about it for themselves. In that respect, Martin Luther was a kind of populist at a time when, to put it mildly, that was not the prevailing assumption. He was that way on that point, a populist and a kind of radical, if I can put it that way, to the end of his life, even though I've stressed that once the Peasants' Revolt took place, he became very conservative on lots of issues. But on that point, which is so fundamental, he never changed. So to the end of his life, he is insisting, get that Bible into the vernacular and get it into the hands of people. And of course, immediately, a whole new industry emerges. All over Western Europe, in one place after another, you've got to have printing presses. You've got to have, and this is a commercial enterprise. People are raising capital. Good Protestants, thinking of this as piety, are raising capital in order to produce books that will be available, some of them wonderfully sort of beautiful and filled with all kinds of woodcuts and incredible things, and then all kinds of different variations in between. A whole new industry is emerging. I've already given you title on this, but I just want to refer it one more time, and that is, you got to read this book, Brand Luther. It's a wonderful book. It's about Luther's, dare I say, exploitation of the printing press. He was a savvy guy in several respects, but one in particular, this new technology is emerging, let's use it. Creating a nightmare for the Roman Catholic Church. Just think about it. Before the 16th century, they didn't have to worry about this problem, and suddenly they have to worry about that problem, and frankly, they've been dealing with this problem ever since. The availability of the text, the printed text in the vernacular, to ordinary people, like ourselves, not clergy. And of course, that raises, I hope you're sensing just the explosiveness of that, raises profound issues of authority, because once people have read the Bible, or even parts of the Bible, even just a few little texts, they're in a position to make judgments about the relationship between what the church is teaching and practicing and the text. It sets up a kind of tension. You've got this, especially if you say this is the standard, the Bible is the standard. And then you look at church practice, you can say, well, why do we do that? Or to be a follower of Jesus is that, but we've got, you know, can you imagine? I mean, that's been going on ever since. Now, today I want to tell the story of how that happened. Or I should say, I want to tell the part of the story of how that happened. First of all, I'm not qualified to tell the whole story, but even if I were qualified to tell the whole story, we would be here for a long time, like more than an hour on a Sunday morning, in order to do justice to it. I'm going to talk about, in a compressed form, the version of this story that has to do with the part that's most relevant to us, and that is the Bible in English. That's all I'm going to talk about. But I want to stress to you, because there, some of you I know have read these other, there are several wonderful books on this, on the English Bible. Just there are several of them. I refer Alistair McGrath in particular in the beginning. It's just a wonderful, again, a good read, a fun read, actually. He's a good historian. But that part of the story, which we're more familiar with because some of the people have been, like McGrath, have been telling it in recent years, is just one of many. There's a German story and a Swedish story and a French story and an Italian story and a Spanish story, and you get my drift. So we would be here for a long time. Background. Once the biblical canon was formed in the 300s, it was translated into Latin, Greek and Hebrew being the biblical languages with some Aramaic, into Latin in the early 4th century by a figure called Saint Jerome. Red light went out. My red light went out. All right, can you hear me? Yes, good. All right. It was translated into Latin. The Bible was translated into Latin in a translation known as the Vulgate translation. But the authoritative translation for Roman Catholic purposes all the way up through the 16th century and beyond in Latin, the ecclesiastical language. By the way, there's a lot to be said for a common ecclesiastical language. Those of you who are in international politics understand this. English is beginning to have that function now, but if you don't have a common cross-national language, needless to say, communication is problematic. And especially before all the modern stuff that we have now to, you know, instant translation and so forth, that was a real problem. Well, with Latin, you had a kind of what? And by the way, it was the language not just of ecclesiastics, but educated people as well. It was the learned language. So somebody in Oxford could communicate fairly effectively with somebody in Wittenberg because they had this common language, and it was the language of the church. And the Vulgate was in Latin. The Roman Catholic Church didn't worry very much about translation in the vernacular all the way through the Middle Ages. There would be occasional figures who would think about this and raise this issue, but it was not a big issue. And insofar as it was raised, I want to flag this at the outset, the Roman Catholic position was, this is a bad idea. Now, for two reasons. I mean, there are 16 reasons you could give, but two reasons in particular. And I want to just hold this out. I know people have to leave early. This is a very important issue to this day, in my opinion. The most fundamental reason was the thought that if you put it into the Bible, into the language of the vernacular, you create a kind of babble. Babble, you know, all sort of proliferation of different versions of the text. But the most important reason I haven't gotten to is, can the ordinary person, even if he or, it would be in that case almost entirely he, but he or she is a learned person, can the ordinary person, the non-expert, really understand it? Now, I know immediately if I opened up a discussion here, we'd have a long discussion about what does really understand means. Take it for granted that just accept that it was less complicated then than it would be now for us to talk about that. There was a clear assumption that there is a right understanding of things. You put it in the hand of every Tom, Dick, and Harry, the presumption was they're going to make mistakes. They're going to make flagrant mistakes. And by the way, when the Council of Trent gets around to arguing about this in the 16th century, that's precisely what they say. Vain and ignorant people, vain and ignorant people, I'm paraphrasing here, will make hash of the Bible. Now, by the way, when I have friendly conversations with Roman Catholics about this matter, they say, what do you think about that? Of course, they're jabbing me here a little bit, you see, because they're looking at the history of Protestantism and they're saying, how's that working out over there among Protestants? Now, I hope you see, that's a serious objection. That's not just authority. Sometimes this is looked at as just a problem of authority. The Roman Catholic Church and power. Roman Catholic Church had the authority and the power, And therefore, they didn't want disseminate. No, it's more complicated than that, for the reason I just indicated. The other reason, which will fascinate you, was they were convinced that vernacular languages were inferior languages which were inadequate to capture the subtleties of Scripture. In other words, Latin was somehow elevated in a way that so many vernacular, and particularly English. English was thought was a godforsaken language. You know, really swinish language. So, I hope you see it's sort of translating pearls into, you know. So, in a way, it's a technical point. Vernacular languages are inadequate to capture the subtleties and richness. Again, that's a point. I'm not going to get into that this morning very much, except just to put that out there. So, the Roman Catholics, shall we say, had some good reasons for resisting this, and boy, they did. When the issue would arise, they'd issue an edict saying, not technically, you cannot have that translation into the vernacular, but you can only do it if it's authorized by appropriate ecclesiastical authorities, a bishop, cardinal, whatever. And when somebody really resisted, well, they'd put some pressure on them, including ultimately burning them at the stake if necessary, if they got too far out of line. So this lasted very well until the 16th century, when two things happen. One, the printing press comes into being, and you've got automatically got a problem, because somebody, if they're inclined to do so, will translate the Bible into the vernacular, and there's going to be some printer probably somewhere who's going to make a mark or make a buck by doing this. But the other reason, and the more fundamental reason, is this. Even before the Reformation, there was this thing called the Renaissance, and figures like Erasmus, who were really interested in going back to original texts, not just biblical texts, but all kinds of other things, Cicero and Seneca and all this stuff. And they looked at these texts that had been handed down in Latin and tested it, because they knew the original languages, Greek and Hebrew and various. They looked at those translations and said, some of these translations are bogus. In other words, there was a technical argument about the inadequacy, and they, Erasmus turned his eyes on the Vulgate and said, the Vulgate is a bad translation. I hope you see. And by the way, Luther's just loving that when he gets around, because you could say purely on linguistic grounds, we need a new translation. And so Erasmus was not part of the Reformation. Erasmus scolds Luther, saying, "Don't be a schismatic." So Erasmus, who was in many respects very similar to Luther on many of these points, stayed in the Roman Catholic Church. Now, I have to say, I got to get this in as in a parenthesis. At this conference we had a couple of weeks ago, I had the Roman Catholic there and the Protestant there. The Roman Catholic said, "I don't think the Reformation was inevitable." Of course, half of us in the room said, What? And not only, he kind of implied it was a bad idea, the Roman Catholic said. It was a bad idea. Why? Because if Luther and other of these hotheads, I'm paraphrasing here, if these hotheads had not been so polemical, maybe over time the Roman Catholic Church could have changed in the right direction, and we wouldn't have had all these terrible consequences that he believes flow from the Reformation. To this day, this is a Roman Catholic at Notre Dame who's saying that today. And he's pointing to Erasmus. We have the Protestant reply here. He missed it. Okay. But nonetheless, just to show you, Erasmus was, you might say, the other party. There were two reform parties. There was the Reformation, and there was Erasmus, who was much more, shall we say, diplomatic in dealing with Roman Catholic authorities. Well, wonderful question. Here we go. What language did Luther read the Bible in? Here it comes. Luther, and by the way, here's the point about this educated clergy I'm about to... Educated in what? Well, above all, they need to know those original biblical languages. That's Luther, that's Calvin. They need to know Greek and Hebrew. And by the way, one of the hallmarks of Presbyterian theological education in particular has been over the years, you cannot get ordained without those languages. We softened up on that like a lot of other things, but that
has that's been the historic practice. And it goes to this. It has to do with this business about being able to really use the text proficiently in that technical sense. Luther and Erasmus are soulmates on the issue of the inadequacy of the Vulgate translation. Everybody with me? They're looking at that and they're saying it's a bad the Vulgate is a bad translation of the Greek and the Hebrew. What? In Latin. In Latin. It's a Latinized Bible. And that's the one that, you know, Luther, frankly, was educated. That's the one, by the way, that Luther did his teaching in. He was a teacher of students, of theological students. So in 1516, remember, 1517 is this anniversary we're commemorating. In 1516, Erasmus turns out a translation of the New Testament from the Greek, which is put over against the Vulgate. Yes. So this is a Greek alternative to, you see, and then, or I should say, from, I'm getting tangled here, from the Greek into the Latin, okay, you see. So this new translation is a kind of, what, an improvement on the Vulgate, and calling into question the adequacy of the Vulgate.
When you say Vulgate, you mean St. Jerome.
Yes. Or variations on that. There was a little. I don't mean to suggest nothing happened, but okay. Luther, now getting to the heart of the Reformation story, Luther, in the period between 1517 and 1520, I've already told you this story, posts the theses, gets disciplined, resists discipline, is excommunicated. By 1520, he's excommunicated. And that is precisely at the point at which he is kidnapped and put in this castle for a period of months. What does he do in this period of his life, a few months? He's translating furiously the Bible into German from the original language. Okay? So, yes, Luther did. And by the way, Calvin did, and you know, right down the line, these guys all stood. See, we stand for translation from the original text. Now, absolutely. And by the way, if that hadn't happened, he'd have been a dead man. In my humble, I don't think that's an unconventional opinion. Yes. So, and note, I hope you see, there are really two things that make Luther different: printing press, political protection. And lasting political protection. Now, back to the story of the Bible. He's got this, and not only that, he's got friends who run printing presses. And there, and this is part of the story of Brand Luther. They start very quickly, as soon as this translation is done, it is made available in thousands of copies in German. Ordinary people are getting the Bible, getting their hands on the. It's just the New Testament, but it's the Bible. Those who can read, of course, wow, look at this stuff. Those who can't read say, maybe I should learn to read. By the way, that's part of the story too, because these Protestants typically make a huge deal of, let's get more schools so that people can learn how to read, so that they can get access to Scripture. Now, in the 1520s, there is like an explosion of translation into the vernacular. The 1520s is the crucial decade, in my opinion. It's the beginning of the Reformation, and the reason it's the beginning of the Reformation, above all, is this precedent set by Martin Luther. There are people coming all the way from other parts of Europe to work in that area in order to participate in this project of translating the text into the vernacular. That's why I said a little bit ago, if I were to tell this story fully, we would be here for a long time. Because there are all these translations being made and being made available. And there are printers who are just grabbing these things and printing them into. And let me just stress, in some places it's easier than others. Because of this prints, translation, publication in that particular part of Germany is much easier. That's one of the reasons why you can get all those copies out. In other places, and frankly the majority of places, it is forbidden. It's forbidden. Now let me just the authorities are just waking up to this crisis, including the Roman Catholic authorities. They're waking up to, my God, what's happening here? Printing, circulation of texts, conversation about texts. In the 1520s, not only do you have this huge circulation of texts, you might say the revolution of the books really begins in the 1520s with these Bibles. But the devices of suppression and repression begin to emerge. Just imagine yourself on the other side here. You see this thing happening. Can you imagine conversations in councils of state? Can you imagine what the conversations would be among ecclesiastical authorities? In England, which I'm going to be talking about more extensively in just a moment, very quickly there are prohibitions on the importation of books published abroad. And when those books, you know, there's a black market that develops, you know? You can imagine. I want to get my hands on that book. What do I pay you, you know? We'll just meet in a corner somewhere to get... I want to believe in a black market in Bible. Can you imagine? Black market in Bible. And some people paying, shall we say, top pound, not top dollar, but top pound in order to get that Bible. But then... You know, the other side of the coin is heavy fines are imposed upon people who engage in that kind of nefarious practice. It's, you know, importing Bibles. Ugh. There are book burnings. That becomes one of the common... By the way, when you think about it, it's a very interesting kind of dramatic symbol. Remember, burning at the stake is one... They had a lot of stuff having to do with fire. Book burnings became a big deal. By the way, I'm amazed... That endured all the way to the latter part of the 17th century. I teach in a lot of my courses a figure called John Locke, one of the important sources of the American founding writings, Whig, political leader, so forth, source of some of the most important phrases even, as well as ideas in the American founding documents. I was interested to learn that in Locke's lifetime, many of his books were publicly burned. You know, because it was a tense time. Locke's, and this is a century later. Anyway, the 1520s are really a turbulent time. Books being burned, people being put in jail. The English government even sends people abroad to kidnap people who were involved in these practices in order to bring them back to England or murder them on the spot. You know, it's not unlike, well, I'm thinking about contemporary analogies, but, you know, you send somebody abroad in order to... shall we say, do away with somebody that's doing something that you don't want done. No American practices like that, I'm sure. Now, let me tell you in 10 minutes the story of the English Bible. The English Bible is, just state it one more time, this will be the last time I say it, one of many Bibles that are produced. By the way, let me just say, the people who are, in some respects, are the most heroic are the ones in Latin, far down south, Europe. Can you imagine being a Spanish Protestant? You know, you got the Inquisition in this period. Or an Italian Protestant. There were such people. And they wanted to translate the Bible into Italian or Spanish or whatever. And they're really... dramatically painful stories of those the things that happened to those people, but they insisted upon it. This is how sort of powerful the story of the Reformation is. These are people who were convinced that they were doing the will of the Lord when they translated the Bible into Italian, even if it meant loss of their lives. But the English version is a dramatic one, and it's a hugely important part of the story of English politics in this period. The main man, the hero of the story, is Tyndale. You know Tyndale. Everybody knows Tyndale. Hmm? Tyndale. There are others, I want to stress, there are others who are heroes, but he's the big guy. Why? Because he, illustrating all the things I've been saying in the last few minutes, Oxford educated, one of these guys who's already getting sort of Luther's, you know, he's part of those conversations going on, and at a time when the English crown is very, very suspicious of these Lutheran ideas, 1520s and 1510s, he is getting sort of convinced that those ideas are probably the ideas he agrees with, and he takes it upon himself in the early 1520s, once he hears about Luther's initiative, Luther's translating the Bible into German and getting away with it. I want to find my way over there and be part of that. And he does. Goes to the area in which Luther is residing. Without any permission. By the way, theologically somewhat educated, but not a terribly learned man. University educated, but not a terribly learned man. You know, but not... I mean, frankly, not in a way that Luther is. Luther's a terribly learned man, and especially in theological matters. After all, he was a professor in these matters, biblical scholar. But Tyndale was committed to this project and engages in the translation of the Bible into English from, same mantra, Greek, New Testament. And then later, once he gets that done, then he adds others. And you get pieces of the Bible being translated. So the full work of his translation and those around him, he has allies, doesn't get completed until the 1530s. You really don't get a full-blown English Bible until the 1530s. Because it's a big project, huh? Big effort. He engages in this and gets the English Bible in the initial form, that is the New Testament, published in 1526. Mark that date, 1526. Now, remember what I said a moment ago. He's abroad. He's on the continent. Those copies of that English translation are forbidden. So that's what's being smuggled back into England. That's what people are getting in trouble for, getting put in jail, and books are being burned. All it's that one. Now, he's a marked man. Eventually, he will be kidnapped by representatives of the English crown. He will be, in the 1530s, he will be strangled. You know, as punishment for his good works. And then his body will be drawn and quartered. Kind of symbol, you know. This is bad guy. Why is he a bad guy? Because he translates the Bible, does the forbidden thing. He becomes, in my opinion, an extraordinarily heroic figure. He's a martyr, exactly. Book of Martyrs, Tyndale. Martyr. Heroic story. Now, he goes abroad, lives abroad, not well subsidized, not well supported. It's kind of his personal project and ends up with that fate. Now, however, and the irony is, this death that takes place is happening just as the civil politics as well as the ecclesiastical politics in England are changing on this issue. Now, everybody in the room knows the story of Henry VIII. I don't need to go through all of that, except he's, of course, the key player here, because 1534, there is this break. Shall we say, for more reasons that are more complicated than just theological reasons. There is this break. Now note what, this is a very fundamental point here. There is this break with Rome. Creating what? Well, 150 years later, they're still fighting about that. Creating what? Well, from Henry's point of view, it is, and by the way, he was a guy who actually fancied himself as theologically aware and articulate. He even wrote some, believe it or not, Henry VIII, theological sort of treatises. In his mind, what was being created there was Anglo-Catholicism. Anglican, Anglo-Catholicism. Now, what does that mean? That means a form of Christianity which has the substance of Roman Catholicism, but is not subordinate to Rome. Clear? And from Rome's point of view, it's a contradiction in terms. From the Anglican point of view, to this day, it's a middle ground, a middle position between being Protestant and being Roman Catholic. Not from the Roman Catholic point of view. The Protestant Roman Catholic point of view is they're Protestants. But note, in the whole ethos of an Anglican church to this day, Episcopal church to this day. What do they call their clergy? Priests. I dare you to call Larry a priest. I dare you. My guess is he's a nice guy. He might tolerate it. But if, shall we say, in some churches, well, David and I, my son and I, we're traveling in Brazil, and we worshipped at a Presbyterian church. Wonderful church. And I couldn't understand a word. David understood it. But at the end of it, we were leaving, and we were explaining ourselves to the pastor, and David called the pastor Padre. Boy, did he get a lecture. Boy, David got a lecture. You know, I'm not a padre. I'm a pastor. And on and on and on. So what's in a word? And, of course, in all of this, what's in a word is enormous. All right. So Tyndale is martyred at a time when Henry VIII is making this transition. But what is Anglo-Catholicism in substance? I've said it's Roman Catholicism without Rome. But there's that whole move that he made unleashes a big debate within the church, within the civil authorities. And one of the key questions is, where do we stand, we Anglo-Catholics, if I can put it that way, on Scripture? Where do we stand? Where do we stand on that? And there were people, currents were swirling around the king, including Anne Boleyn, who, by the way, Anne Boleyn, there's a wonderful play about this called Anne Boleyn, but I commend that to you, but apart from that, we know that Anne Boleyn came from a highly Protestant, dare I say, Reformed family, and she was kind of committed to getting the Bible out there into what? Officially recognized status. As a matter of fact, in the play, this is clearly apocryphal, goes out on a secret mission and has a chat with Tyndale. Can you imagine? I don't think that happened, but she was clearly, you might say, on the Tyndale side. There's currents swirling around Henry VIII, and the people who are on the Protestant side prevail, at least initially. And there is a new translation, which is sort of a variation on Tyndale, which Coverdale Bible, which quickly, a few years, they get Henry VIII to embrace as the official Bible of the realm. And part of that is a decree. It's sort of delicious to think about it. A decree saying there will be a great Bible. It was called the Great Bible. There will be a great Bible, which is a copy of which published and put in every parish, every church. Just one. It's not a Bible for every man or every woman, but note the symbolism of that. And it's there. It's on public display. If you want to go, you know, if David wants to go and take a look at this Bible, there it is. He can actually read it for himself. He just can turn the pages on Friday afternoon. And the implication was there will be preaching from the Great Bible. Another important point. Preaching previously, what was preaching? I'm tempted to make a very disparaging remark about Catholic preaching. I will resist that. But let's say from the time of the Reformation on, there was an idea that preaching would be biblical exposition. Why is it? On Sunday morning, I've been here many times, you have the reading of Scripture followed by, if the clergy are at all sensitive to what they're supposed to be doing, they're expounding Scripture, right? That's a very Protestant and, in our case, very Reformed idea. All right, Great Bible, 1539. Emerging in the struggle that was set in motion by Henry VIII's break were three parties: Roman Catholics, who detested the whole thing. They wanted to reverse all of that, turn all that back. Anglo-Catholics, they weren't called that at the time, but they became, eventually they were called that, the party of this sort of middle ground. And then our spiritual forebears, Puritans. That's our stock, the Puritans. And the Puritans were called that in part because they were purists about rather specific, a whole series of specific issues, but one of them was, what kind of translation is going to be made available, and how is the Bible going to be used in the church? And they were not satisfied at all with the Great Bible. They were not satisfied at all with the idea that one Bible would be there. One Bible would be put in the church, in contrast to, well, you know what they wanted. See, and already, in Henry VIII's age, you begin to get this, but even more in the 1550s and thereafter, you get this Puritan party. Eventually, of course, a good number of those Puritans, like 20,000 of them, leave England and come to these shores because of these issues that I'm talking about right now. Henry VIII dies in the mid-1540s. He is replaced first by a son who is much more Protestant than he is. He's sickly. He dies and is replaced by Bloody Mary. Now, why do we call her Bloody Mary, who is queen for just a few years? Eventually, she dies and is replaced by, I'm going to do an un-Presbyterian thing, say, the great Elizabeth, you know, the great Queen Elizabeth, who is queen for a long, long time, you know, decades. Bloody Mary. Why do we call her Bloody Mary? Because she was a Roman Catholic. She wanted to restore the status quo ante. She wanted to do that. But she detested this notion that the Bible should be out there in any form. Banned it immediately. You know, almost as soon as she came to power. You know, attempted to say within the first 24 hours. No, I don't know whether it happened that quickly, but it happened very quickly. That the Bible, which had been in the churches, was gone. Symbolic act. But more importantly, any of that stuff connected with publishing the Bible and making it available, you do that, you're in deep trouble, because she killed a lot of people. A lot of people. And a good number went off to German cities and Geneva. Background to, in a way, the centerpiece of my whole story today. They're called the Marian Exiles, Mary's Exiles. The Marian Exiles, by the way, one of whom was John Knox, who went from Scotland. They went on to the continent of Europe, settled in Reformed cities, that is, cities that were dominated by Reformed leaders, like John Calvin. Now, the group that went to Geneva play a hugely important role in the story of the English Bible, because there was a team of them led by a man whose name you've probably never heard, called Whittingham. A group of people who, they got this Bible bug. Boy, they had it with a vengeance. I've already told you they didn't like the Great Bible as a piece of writing. And they wanted to create a Bible which was consistent with their theological understanding, which could be made available to everybody as a kind of study Bible. That was a very important part of to make a study Bible. And they settled down in their exile. And by the way, they hoped and they prayed to the Lord that their exile would be short so that they could go back to England and complete the Reformation. That was another very important part of their thinking. We want a church which is truly reformed, not that bogus one that Henry VIII created. We want a church that's truly reformed. A good part of the 1550s in Geneva were spent by many people, including this man, Whittingham, who sort of was the chairman of the team, creating a full English translation of the Bible. It's a huge volume. You know, it's like these in the original printing. It's just a mammoth. It's about, I've got one out of the library, and Betty reminded me on the way here that I should have brought it today. It's just this huge thing, like these pulpit Bibles. You know, these people, you've seen the pulpit Bibles in our church. It's always carried up there on Sunday morning. You know, it's part of what I consider to be a wonderful ceremony. You know, here comes the word, you know. And then somebody traipses out afterwards. But it's a huge Bible. Now, there were many other versions, including ones that we today would characterize as kind of average, typical book size, which were meant to be pocket size for the time. But I'm getting ahead of myself. They made a translation of the Bible, which was technically pretty good. technically pretty good. Keep in mind, these people are very concerned about the technical adequacy of the text. But it had several other qualities. And by the way, it finally gets published in 1560. Just as Queen Elizabeth is coming to the throne, Mary is gone. They have prayed to the Lord. And the Lord in his mercy relieved Mary and brought us Queen Elizabeth, that they thought was going to be the great Protestant, the great Protestant queen. As a matter of fact, the Geneva Bible has an introduction, which dedication to the great Elizabeth, queen of Protestant England. It turned out to be a little more complicated than that, but it was a little bit wishful thinking. So it had that, first of all. But it had also, it had been reviewed by none other than John Calvin, who put his imprimatur on it. You know, this is a good translation, says, you know, by that point already, he's near the end of his life, he's pretty much an authoritative figure in the Reformed world. That's a good question. Yeah, sure he would, yeah. Then, the other things about it, though, and this is the thing that really is important for understanding it, it includes enormous amount of, we today would call them annotations, editorial comments on the text, like almost every other verse. Hundreds and hundreds of pages designed to do what? To get you to sort of understand the text in the right way. It was a study Bible in other respects. It included maps. It included diagrams. It was just an incredible sort of, I mean, it would compete with any good study Bible today. And this is for lay people. This is not for clergy. So Elizabeth, confronted with this, and by the way, it was published, of course, on the continent, in Geneva. Geneva, by that point, was just a hotbed of publishing. You know, there were all these publishers who gravitated to Geneva, where you could make a franc, you could do well, and it was published, and then initially brought back sort of cautiously to England, and then once it became clear, Elizabeth is confronted with this, and Elizabeth says, "Okay, we'll allow this in." And it becomes the most popular Bible in the English-speaking world in the latter part of the 16th century. Scores of people have it. But as things evolve, Elizabeth gets uneasy with it. Why? Because if you read it, it's clearly got a Puritan edge to it. And by the way, the Roman Catholics have always said interpretation is implicit in translation. Let me say that again. Interpretation is implicit in translation. It's a very important point. Let me give you an example. A couple of them just set the crown's teeth on edge. There was running through it a lot of snotty stuff in translation said about monarchs. There was kind of an implication running through a lot of the text that monarchs are basically tyrants. And you know, there's a lot of stuff in the Bible that kind of does suggest that, and the thrust of the translation was to highlight that kind of, shall we say, anarchistic tendency. But another one, which if you were at all strongly Catholic, would just get your juices going in a bad way, was the translation of the term presbyteros. Presbyteros. Now, the Roman Catholics were used to translating that as priest. Presbyteros. Used to translating that as priest, okay? All the way through their Latin, priest. Well, that wasn't the Puritan way. Puritans used words like elder, which had all kinds of other connotations and really took away the priestly function from the pastor, in effect. By the way, that's one of the key ideas, that I hope you understand, the priest is a mediator between you and God, right? That's the priestly function, standing there literally. That would be the part of the technical reason why, Larry, if you said Father Hayward, he would say, what? I think he would. I hope he would. because he doesn't conceive himself as playing a priestly role in that sense. Indeed, I think he thinks there's only one figure who plays that role, and that's Christ. Christ is the high priest in that sense, but not anybody else, even the Pope at Rome. It's not priestly in that sense, from our point of view. Anyway, running through the translation were all kinds of, shall we say, variations on words. And anybody who's done any translation of a sensitive document knows it doesn't take very much flicking of words here and there to change somewhat the tone of it, the meaning of it. So, the Geneva Bible came to be perceived as a seditious document. And here's the problem. It's popular. It's very popular. And by the way, the English was wonderful. This is the one, not King James, that Shakespeare used. You know? And by the way, it became very formative in the shaping of the character of the English language. All kinds of phrases that you know well come from the Geneva Bible, which, by the way, was based upon Tyndale with these kind of variations of a Puritan kind. It was certainly the one that the Pilgrim Fathers and others coming to this shore, these shores, would have relied upon. But note, it's got a kind of Puritan translation to it. It's got all of these side notes, which, if they leave you any doubt, suggest, you know, that monarchy is to be viewed with suspicion, and on and on. As a result of that, by the end of Elizabeth's reign, there was a sense in the monarchy, we've got to do something about this Bible. And I hope you see, this is a complicated political cultural problem. It's out there. It's influencing people. It's shaping their views. That's the background of the King James Version. Because when Elizabeth is replaced, James comes to the throne. James comes to the throne from Scotland, eventually becomes King of England, replacing Elizabeth. All the Presbyterians in Scotland and many Puritans as well said, we finally going to get our real Puritan king. Not so fast. He came from Scotland with a dim view of Presbyterians. Particularly, he thought he'd picked up on this anti-seditious quality. You know, this kind of anti-monarchical bent that they had. So at a famous conference where he was presented with a list of, they were almost demands from English Puritans, agreed to the creation of a new English translation of the Bible done by the very best scholars. And he put together a vast team. It was an incredible team of people drawn mainly from English universities. You know, the most qualified of the divines who could participate in that. And he produced, and it was issued in 1611, a translation which was different. It was still Tyndale. By the way, Tyndale is the one all the way through. They're relying on variations on Tyndale. They're tweaking Tyndale. But if you look at the King James Bible carefully, first of all, it doesn't have all of the study aids, quote-unquote, which would put the Geneva spin on everything. But the other thing is, the translation is done in a way that takes away many of these partisan Puritan elements. It softens those points. And it became, eventually, more popular than the Geneva Bible. But here's what happened. There was a struggle that happened very quickly. A lot of people said, who were, shall we say, rather strongly partisan Protestants, we don't like this King James Bible. We're going to hold on to our Geneva Bible. We want our Geneva Bible. It's kind of ironic when you think about later developments. We want our Geneva Bible. We don't want this new, innovative King James thing. Well, in order to solve that problem, James issued an edict saying there will be no more publication of the Geneva Bible, because the Geneva Bible was being reprinted and reprinted and reprinted because there was this demand. Stop it! 1611. Stop it! And so, naturally, over time, it became more and more difficult to get the Geneva Bible, and the King James Bible became eventually the more influential. Now, with maybe 2 minutes to go, I want to just briefly make two other points here. Two other points about all of this. Protestants have said from the time of the Protestant Reformation on, the 1520s on more specifically, put the book in the hands of people, let them read it for themselves, and make of it what they will for themselves. And that is, I would say, the simple, dare I say, simplistic view of what happened. But it's not really what happened, for the following reason. Very quickly, like in Luther's case, within 5 years, he's already producing, in the 1520s, a catechism. What is that catechism designed to do? It's designed to get people thinking correctly about the Bible. Roman Catholics, very interested in that. You know, they say, well, you say you put it in people's hands and let them read it for themselves, but in the very next breath you hand them a catechism written by, sometimes they say snidely, Pope Martin, in order to make sure that they read it rightly. Now, Martin was just the beginning. That was just the beginning, because all the way through the 16th century you get, what, catechisms and confessions written by Protestants for Protestant churches. And as a matter of fact, very quickly, our church is probably a perfect example of this. We're confessional through and through. We adopt these confessions. And by the way, they were enforced far more rigorously in the 16th century or the 17th century than later. It was said over and over again, if you want to be ordained in this church, you're going to subscribe to what? Those confessions. It's what the Book of Confessions, that's what their original purpose was, to articulate for the moment, Westminster Confession, articulate for the moment what we as a church understand to be, now let me complete that sentence, the truth of Scripture. Let me say that again. What we as a church understand, in other words, this is a, what, authoritative interpretation of Scripture. And if you're a good Roman Catholic, you would say, well, wait a minute, I thought everybody could read it for themselves. Aren't you suggesting here that there's a right way to read it and that your church tells you what the right way is? And by the way, those of us that have stand-in confessional churches, we've been in that position ever since. I'm perfectly prepared to embrace that, shall we say, ambiguity, but it is, I think, a bit naive to say Protestants just put the book in the hands of the lay person and say, read it for yourself. It's more complicated than that. It's more complicated than that because we do believe in, I think we still believe in, some degree of difference between right and wrong interpretations. There are some interpretations I'm prepared to say, that's just wacko. My guess is probably most everybody in this room. Even if you're not prepared to say there's a right one, you've probably got an intuition. There's some that are just off the charts, right? Now, final comment. 1 minute. What was the Roman Catholic response to all of this? I hope you can imagine. It makes your head spin to think about the problem they were dealing with. Two things. Number one, the Council of Trent, which was their authoritative response to the Protestant Reformation. Over 2.5 decades, they gathered together some of the best minds in the Roman Catholic Church and meditated on, reflected on, debated on the challenge of the Reformation. One of the things that happened in that period was the following. They declared in a very strong way, vernacular interpretations of the Bible are forbidden unless they are authorized by a proper ecclesiastical authority. That's number one. Two, anything which is not a translation authorized by the church is forbidden for access by lay people. And it was put on the papal index. So right at the top of the papal index is the Bible. And of course, what that meant in practice was very few lay people got access to or really were interested in access to the Bible. A different religious culture developed. The religious culture of Roman Catholicism in the modern era until Vatican II was a non-biblical culture, largely. So that if you'd say, even at a place like Georgetown, the story of Jonah and the whale. Really? What was that story? I kid you not. You know? In a Protestant setting, you would say, well, of course, you know that. I think you still would say that. That's one thing. Second thing, however, And it's just so fascinating, I think, to reflect on. Even in the Roman Catholic world, there were people who still said, well, we could do our own translation here. I'll get authorization and we'll do a translation. Right? And, therefore, there were authorized Roman Catholic translations. The most famous one is something called the Douay Rheims translation, which was the kind of modern Roman Catholic translation, accessible translation in English. That was the English translation, done in the late 16th century, already at the time of, you know, the beginning of all this. A couple of, you know, people who really are good, devout Roman Catholics, but sense this Protestant thing, there's some value to it. But here's an authorized translation. And therefore, if you were in the English-speaking world, and you were a Roman Catholic, devout Roman Catholic, and wanted, maybe because you were friends with a Protestant or something, wanted to get access to this text, you could get access to the Douay Rheims. And I hope you see how that opens up the door to, in a very important way, Catholicism beginning to become, in its own way, like this Protestant literate culture that was emerging at the time of the Reformation. The completion of that story is the following. Vatican II was just an incredible event in many ways. We're still feeling the effects of it. One of the most important is a whole section of the documents coming out of Vatican II inviting lay people to read the Bible. And there's a flat statement there. Reading of the Bible should be encouraged among the faithful as much as possible. Of course, a lot of other stuff in there too, but and I've heard people say, and I'm not sure this is quite right, but I've heard people say Vatican II was in a certain way the council that Luther asked for in 1517. Certainly on that point, you could say, yes, absolutely. Now, as usual, I don't know who's in charge. You're in charge. Are we out of time? We're out of time. If you want to pose questions to me, come see me.